It's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. I am your host, Gene Bolduc, and I am joined today by Sarah Verbeest of the UNC School of, now give me, you have about 27 titles, but you're with the School of Social Work as well as the Jordan Institute for Families, correct?
Yes, the Jordan Institute for Families is part of the School of Social Work.
Fantastic. And do you, how many times a year do you get to meet Michael Jordan? That's what I need to know first. It's WCHL, it's the Chapel Hill Station.
I've never met Michael Jordan, I have had the opportunity to meet his mother several times.
So much better.
She is amazing, and I'm a fangirl.
Oh, please tell me something about Michael Jordan that you learned from his mother that nobody would guess was true. Something adorable from his childhood that we never get to hear about. There must be something. His favorite cookie. I don't know anything. You need to think on this question because these are the things that you've got to know. Man.
Well, she does talk about how much he practiced just shooting hoops in their driveway over and over and over and over again.
Man, what an investment, that basketball hoop. You know, I had one at my house. I think I've had two, actually. We had one that was on the house, and then we had the more portable one that's sort of elsewhere in the neighborhood now, and I don't know how much anybody even uses it. I could have the next Michael Jordan in my neighborhood, and I wouldn't even know it. You're probably just wearing the stripes right off that.
Well, you'd have to have the Michael Jordan's mom in your neighborhood.
Yeah,
she's truly an incredible person. You can see where he came from when you meet her.
Really?
Yes.
That's wonderful. And does she still lives in North Carolina, or is she elsewhere?
She's in Chicago sometimes, and then she's in Charlotte sometimes. She's very involved with our School of Social Work.
Oh, fantastic.
Provides a lot of advice and support to me in my role in our school.
Oh,
she's great.
That's so great. Wow, what a nice little kickoff point. It all starts with moms, you know. Dads, too, but I have to say I came to contact you because I learned about your program, the fourth trimester, right?
That's right.
And, of course, those of us who are proximate to Latin know that a trimester is a thing with three parts, so it's the fourth part of something with three parts. And, you know, what we're talking about is the first 12 weeks after you have a baby, and that we live in a world that as women and as new mothers kind of sets us up, doesn't it? And we, you know, they send us home with a brand new baby, and it's like the end of all those children's books where you lived happily ever after because you have this beautiful baby that's going to wake up screaming every 2 hours. I always love that expression about I slept like a baby, and whenever I hear that, I think, really? You woke up every 2 hours screaming your head off? So let's talk about, you know, reality at the risk of intruding on the fairy tale. The reality is that when you come home, you may or may not have large numbers of family members who are actually helpful to you. And so what are the things that, you know, you've done a lot of research in this and you just know this as a practical matter yourself. What are the things, what are the misconceptions that people have about how it is when you have a new baby beyond the exhaustion, which is saying a lot?
Sure. So, you know, I remember we had our daughter at the birth center here in Chapel Hill.
Yay.
Maureen Darcy caught her. And I still remember getting in the car and like, you're not coming with us. It's just us.
What's the deal?
No, what do we do?
We have room. We don't mind.
Exactly. And, I had a master's in social work. I had a master's in public health in maternal and child health. So you would have thought, right? We had some preparation.
Right.
So we, you know, drive home with the hazard lights on. And
that's fantastic.
And I had excellent, wonderful care. But there was so much about just my postpartum body that I had not expected.
Yeah.
And I felt really a little duped and angry a little bit because I didn't realize all the leakiness, the aches, the pains, and all just the things that had happened after I had the baby, how mushy my abdomen was.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Which means that your back is pretty challenged, too, because you don't have the muscle.
the shoulder, the neck pains from breastfeeding, and, you know, breastfeeding, it hurts at first.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I think that it initially there was just a lot of surprise and thinking, I should have known this. I have these degrees. And so I think we have a lot of preparation for childbirth, and we get a lot of baby care products and clothes and everything baby needs at our showers. But we really don't get a lot of preparation about what to expect after the baby.
Right.
And I think there's the assumptions, and it's a wonderful thing to welcome a being into your life, to your family.
Right.
So it's supposed to be a joyful time, and it is. But it's also very challenging physically and emotionally. I also remember walking up the stairs carrying her.
Okay,
and I just had this thought.
Hard to begin with.
Well, and I had this thought. I'm like, I'll never read a book again.
Right. It's so true. It's so true. You're like, first of all, I have enough trouble carrying my own body up the stairs.
Right.
Carrying another person, totally maxed out. That's, you know, that's the, after my first child, I had stairs in my house, and I had to limit the number of times in the day that I could go up and down the stairs because I just didn't have the goods to do it.
So you figure there's this, so many things have changed. You know, you could, I remember holding her, looking at her in the middle of the night, and first of all thinking, I'm exhausted, I can't do this. And then the next minute, my heart busting open with this, like, deep love and sense of the universe, you know. And so it's just such a wonderful, crazy time of physical recovery, emotional recovery, and then relationships, seeing if you have a partner, how your partner is responding, and how your family is responding. So it's a very exciting time, and women actually have a lot of things that they're accomplishing during that time.
Mm-hmm.
They're recovering physically from this marathon that their body's just completed.
Right.
They are adjusting to their own identity as a mother of this particular child.
Yes.
which is a lot. We've had a mom in one of our focus groups said that, you know, I used to be Rachel, and now I'm Jalen's mom.
Right.
And so there's this, who am I anymore? And then there's the care for your family, you know, the roles that
we
have.
Yeah, like remember them,
Right. So this is a lot of things that new moms are balancing and finding their new normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then doing this also with a lot of changing hormones.
Right.
And a lot of feelings. And it's also very logistically challenging to take care of this little small being. And most parents, the vast majority of parents, are really focused on keeping this little one alive.
Right. And that little baby has no medical history. You know, you don't know if what the baby's going to do. Nobody knows. The baby doesn't know. And to me, that was the scariest part. It was like, he could be allergic to this and that and the other thing. We're just going to have to find out.
Right.
And that's kind of scary.
It is. And, you know, we didn't realize our daughter bended. Like, we just kept holding her. And then the nurse came to our house a few days after, and she was, like, moving her all around. We're like, you're going to break her. So so there's just a lot of adjustment. And, you know, kind of layering this, I was very fortunate that I was able to take time off of work.
Yeah.
And I was was able to be paid for a good part of that time.
Yeah.
And we did not have very much money then, and we would have been in a real panic.
Yeah.
If we had had to go 6 weeks, 8 weeks without any income coming in for me.
Right.
And we know that a good number of moms are headed back to work within 10 days after having a baby because
I can't imagine.
They don't really have a choice. So I think we had a roof over our heads, and we had heat, you know, we had a lot of those things taken care of for us that other families, we forget, don't have that security as well. We had diapers taken care of for our child. We know that about a quarter of families in North Carolina have diaper insufficiency. And there's clear links between not having enough diapers or for your baby and depression.
Right.
Makes sense, right?
So, yeah, because it's such a basic thing, and it's very basic for the baby's comfort as well.
Right. And then I think we're thinking also there's interesting family dynamics that can happen.
Yeah.
It can be
That's
really...
That's so politely put. That's so politely put.
I think on all fronts, I think that for women who've lost their mothers, it can be a very sad time.
That's got to be a real roller coaster, because you're having one of the happiest events in your life and your mom isn't there to share it with you. And I felt that. I told you before that I've just recently become a grandmother, and my mom passed away in 2011, and I feel sometimes a little pang about that. Well, and my mother-in-law too, that they never. But of course, my mother-in-law, if my mother-in-law were alive today, she'd say, "Look at me, I'm almost 100 years old." I mean, it just becomes silly after a point, you know. But you notice those missing chairs at the table,
right,
you know, at big events, but then you can take that and realize that it's kind of your job to infuse that sentiment into the moment, which I'm fairly good about doing, saying, "Oh, my mother would have loved this," and I'll tell the story and make the connection. And I have to say, before we go to our break, that I have found that my children are much more interested in my mom's stories now that they're parents. It's a lot more fascinating to know about that day when he took his first steps and did this and did that and did the other thing. And we've had these stories all along, but they just weren't as compelling, I guess, as they are now that they can see what that really looks like right under their noses and make the comparison themselves. And I mean, that includes the fact that this kid looks like a clone of his father, if you ask me. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. We're talking with Sarah Verbeest. Now, should I be calling you doctor? Or are you like Rachel Maddow? You just drop the doctor. You just, everybody knows you have a doctorate, and you just don't flash it around so much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We could just call you Dr. Sarah. You could start a whole new. You can be the next Dr. Phil, only way, way better. Way better. Okay, so now we've got mom past the, you know, you're home from the hospital, and, you know, really, I mean, my recollection is that those first 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, it's a pretty tough slog because of the straight up physical recovery from childbirth. It's like a very, very long cycle, shall we just say. And I remember that the first time that I got 4 or 5 hours of sleep in a row, I felt like I had, you know, put on a cape and could do anything. That's probably also kind of a vulnerable period, too, because you start thinking you can figure this all out and get it all done. And then, of course, probably pretty quickly, most of us kind of hit a wall. Like, no, you can't do it all. Nobody can do everything. And you know, I love women. I think we're wonderful, but we're bad at asking for help. It's hard for us to ask for help.
Well, I think it's because we're socialized not to ask for help. That's especially for mothers. I think we have this fear of being seen as a bad mother.
Yeah, you're a failure if you need somebody else to help you out.
Exactly. And I think that when we look at the conversation that we're seeing in social media in different spaces, we're starting to say we need to change that narrative. We need to recognize that this is a big task. It's an important task. And I think that along those lines, for example, I think we should make some things just easier. We should just offer everyone mental health services and not make it like, well, if you screen positive, you can have this. I think making that much more widely available with easy to access care in your OBGYN's office would take away some of the stigma and also make it so she's not having to ask. It's there. The same thing for lactation support. Or other services that she might need. Just we need to make it so easy. So it's almost you're saying no instead of asking for help.
Right.
And I think along those lines, it can also be really challenging. We were starting to talk a little bit about grandparents and in-laws on either side can be really interesting.
Yes.
For people figuring out how they want to help the new mom, and I think for people, maybe friends, realizing that this child has brought a real change into that life.
Yeah.
And so We're starting to have some conversations with our project to be thinking about what is the best way to communicate with all the people in your life in terms of what you need. So right. Something that we've been talking about is, you know, could we have a postpartum plan? So we have all the birth plan.
Right.
But could we be thinking about maybe what we might need and setting up some of those caring meals, you know, in advance of the baby coming, or just kind of being proactive so you don't have to be asking for that when you're in the middle of needing it. And also thinking about how other people can approach new mom. So maybe not making assumptions, but saying, can I bring you this? Or would this be okay? We've heard right. sometimes when people say, well, how can I help you? Sometimes you don't even know what you need at that time.
Right, right.
But also making those always offers, not assumptions. So
right.
I think that these are some of the conversations that are happening. And figuring out how to also negotiate relationships is also very important.
Yeah, you have to be, you know, my kids were, my son and daughter-in-law, and when I say my kids, my daughter-in-law is like the third child that I didn't have. They were very fortunate in that, in terms of their managing all of this with their new child. Almost all of their friends had children. And had children, you know, before Brian and Jamie did. And so, you know, so they inherited a lot of stuff, you know, and a lot of it's at my house. So there are car seats and strollers and pack and plays and clothes. And that's fantastic and has saved them a lot of money. And that's wonderful. But they've also just been through all of this and supporting their friends and how they've had children and seeing what they need and what they really need and what they don't really need. And likewise, their friends have been waiting and waiting for them to. They waited a long time to have kids. And so this has been like the long-awaited, this is finally the last group in the class to have a baby. And so their friends have been, you know, just wonderfully supportive and can tell them, you know, like one of their best friends, they have five kids. And one of them, who they maybe would have called, oops, what do you know about that? The fifth one came along just after Brian and Jamie were having theirs. And so surprisingly, they're kind of trailing along with this last kid. And this last kid, who's younger than my grandson, walked much sooner. Well, sure he did. He's got four older siblings. He's going to have to keep up. It's a whole different thing than being the first and only kid. Mm-hmm. And it is fascinating to see those contrasts, but also there is the family dynamic and there's how your friends support you. And so they've been very lucky to have that example of friends reaching out to each other and supporting each other. And, you know, plus we haven't even talked about this really about all the groups that are out there on social
right.
media that can be absolutely fantastically
helpful. Exactly. I was glad you started this part of the conversation because I think that it can be very isolating to be
right.
a new parent. We,
yeah.
we hear that a lot from the different women that we've worked with and that we see on social media, that it can be very isolating.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think some of the services that we provide, I think home visiting is great. I think care management is great. But sometimes we kind of forget to help build the family social capital,
right.
which is introducing them to other young families
right.
so that they can start to become dependent with each other
mm-hmm.
and learn together and help each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also not a lot of places where it's easy for young families to just convene and be
right.
together and meet each other.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, thinking about what would it be like if we had more breastfeeding-friendly businesses
right.
in Chapel Hill and Carrboro or anywhere so that it would be okay to be able to go and have a dinner or time with friends and be able to feed your baby as well, or just
right.
more places where young families can get together. And I think that that would be another great support that we as communities can start to offer new families.
Yeah, that's so important. And by the way, and when children are young and breastfeeding, just being able to get out of the house and get away from those four walls and and all of that, and hang out with people who are in the same spot. And it's more than just a mom's morning out. I mean, it needs to be, you know, that you belong in these places, you know. And,
right.
I think you're right about businesses need to be, you know, a lot more supportive and welcoming about that. But also the patrons in those businesses, while, you know, not freaking out about breastfeeding. We can talk a little bit when we come back about the phenomenon of how you support other people who are parents in restaurants and in grocery stores and in all of these encounters that we have as part of everyday life. And these little things that you can do are absolutely, can be absolutely a lifeline for a young parent who feels the stress of the checkout line and the toddler's having a meltdown. And we'll talk about that meltdown when we come back. That's a good hook, right? we'll talk about stopping that meltdown when we come back. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more on The Meltdown. Okay, we're back with Sarah Verbeest, and I'm talking about nonsense because that's what I'm good at. So here's my story. My story is that you know, when you're in the checkout line and there's somebody there who is just got a toddler, and I mean I it's like I can feel a chill running down my spine remembering what this feels like. You're there and you've gone through the grocery store, you've taken your 30 minutes to not only choose the groceries, but put back all the things that your toddler grabbed off the shelf when you weren't looking. And so you've gone through this and you've got this project completed, right? And you're checking out. And then in the checkout line, of course, are all of these products that are meant to torment your child and tempt them with, you know, gum and candy and everything else. And for a young child, that might just be that it's brightly colored and interesting and they just want to touch it and look at it. But so there you are saying the word that you hate to say to children, you know, most of the time, no, 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 no. And pretty soon a toddler is going to start getting unhappy about that. And as a child is, you know, kind of starting to melt down, the mom... we were just talking about, you know, it being difficult to ask for help. The mom feels like I'm putting on display that I'm a bad parent, even though, of course, that is not true. I see you have a toddler. That's the answer to that. You know, is this a bad mom? No, this is a toddler. So, I mean, I see you've gone shopping with the Tasmanian devil. That's what you're really doing. Okay, let's just be serious about that. So, in those situations, even though we certainly want to caution children about strangers picking them up and, you know, and that sort of thing, tell me where I'm wrong. I've never found it to be a problem, because I respect the personal space of the people involved. But when I'm behind that situation as an older person, you know, I'll try to, you know, play peekaboo with the child or just do something to distract the child from whatever the issue is at hand, and just talk to them. And I don't talk baby talk to children. I just talk to them. And you can see the relief of the mom, mm-hmm. that somebody is right. validating that this is not easy.
Exactly.
And that's like a miracle for a young parent, isn't it? That simple thing of
right.
just...
And it's too bad it has to be a miracle. Why can't we build those kind of supports everywhere? I think we hear a lot about mom blame. And mom, you know, like,
yeah.
and especially, I think all moms are vulnerable. We all want to do the best that we can, but especially brand new moms, they're really trying to figure it out.
Right.
And there can be a lot of people around them that are telling them what to do or how to do it, and maybe not even providing consistent information. whether it's pediatrician, their OBGYN, someone down the street, their mother-in-law. So there's just a lot of information that's being thrown at her. And it's really easy for her to feel like she's not doing a good job.
Right.
And so I think how we can disrupt that, that judgment, I think would be a wonderful way to make a big difference for new families, for sure. And I think also, you know, we were talking about a little bit before, you know, we can maybe blame moms because they're not breastfeeding, or, you know, there's so many different ways that we can blame the choices that people make without
right.
thinking that there are systems around them that can make things difficult. So
right.
if you have to go back to work at just 10 days postpartum, it can be very difficult to continue to breastfeed your child.
Right.
So, example, if you things like if you go to your place of work and they don't provide a place for you to express your milk that's clean and quiet.
Right.
Like, but we're going to blame her and not blame the system.
Right.
So our project and our team is like, it's time we start looking at systems issues and policy issues
right.
and these structures
right.
that can make things so difficult. Trying to get all the services that she might need if she needs to get nutrition services and over here and get the diapers over there and get this. You know, we just can make things so difficult when they don't need to be. And then we blame her for being late.
Right.
Or not showing up.
Right, right.
Or not doing something right.
Or being a little distracted during the day.
Exactly.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, our team, so I want to give a shout out to Allison Stubbe and Suzanne Woodward and Kristen Tully and Amelia Gibson and Venus Standard, who are our team, because we're trying to change this conversation.
Right.
And just say it's kind of that we got to shift some things up a little bit here.
You know what this reminds me of? It's just come to me as you're describing this. This reminds me a lot about dealing with racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to inject a hot subject into our conversation, but it reminds me so much of that because it's so much better to look at structures that support racism. It's so much better to look at that and learn how to disrupt that instead of pointing fingers and saying, you're a racist. You said a racist thing. You're a racist. You did a bad thing. You're a racist. Okay, so he's a racist. Now what? You know, how are you helping anybody with the point and blame? And this is so similar. I know it's not the same, but it just reminds me of that.
Well, it's absolutely a critical part of this conversation. So when we look at bigger outcome issues and mm-hmm. we look at really important statistics around infant mortality, which is
right.
Babies who don't live to their first birthday, we are seeing increased disparities in North Carolina. So
right.
Black babies are almost 3 times more likely to die before their first birthday than white babies. And then when we look at maternal mortality and also morbidity, so moms dying or being very sick,
right.
we are seeing even greater inequities for women of color, 4 to 5-fold compared to white women. So I think
that's got to be structural, right?
I think it's because we live in a white-dominated
right.
white supremacist system where
right.
everything is aligned on whiteness. And so I think it's
right.
multi-layered. It's both it can be at an interpersonal level. It can be
mm-hmm.
At a system level. And then it can also start to feel internalized as well. So,
but for the babies not surviving and for the mothers either dying or being sicker, this is almost certainly a structural barrier to access to health care and to wellness and everything that's involved in that, which is access to a doctor, but it's also, you know, nutrition and preventive stuff, right?
Well, I think it's also stress, the daily
right.
wear and tear of stress.
Yeah.
You know, moms of color talking about part of the reproductive justice equation is that your children will be safe and can grow up
right.
well. And when we think about what women of color see in the news all the time, how
right.
can that not create a great sense of stress? So I think it's a really critical issue, and I think it can be at small levels where there may be providers that think women experience pain differently based on their race and ethnicity. And this, we know, is happening, you know, all the way up to these bigger systems that have created less wealth in certain communities than others based on, you know, policies around segregation, redlining, et cetera.
Right, right.
So I'm glad you brought that up because we can't have this conversation without recognizing that some moms have an even have even more barriers in front of them and more challenges. And those are the women that our fourth trimester project is really trying to center in our work.
So I was in a restaurant, I don't know, probably 2 years ago or something, and my husband and I were just having lunch at Chili's, and there was a couple there with two young children. And the restaurant was almost empty, actually. It was mostly just us. And they were really managing the kids. And they would glance over at us from time to time. This was an African-American family and my white husband and me, and my white husband and my white self. And these parents, the mom, I could see her glancing over toward me and saying to and shushing the children and you know, encouraging them not. And these were like, you know, an almost school age child and a toddler. And I just had a feeling like they were worried that if the kids were making too much noise, that was going to be a problem for us. Now that's just a total supposition on my part, but that's what my feeling was. And so so we're eating. So eventually, the kids were kids, and they were, in my judgment, they were perfectly well-behaved. And so I just went over to them after a while, and I just said, you know, I don't mean to interrupt your lunch, but I just wanted to tell you I think your children are beautiful, and I think you guys are doing a great job. And you know, enjoy your day. I admire your children, and you look like your great parents. And, you know, then we went back with, I mean, and again, you just could feel the relief. It was like, and I thought to myself, oh, why don't put yourself through that? What if I had a problem with you? What do you care?
Well, I think that's there's just so much in that encounter that we could have a whole other show to talk about in terms of power and privilege and how, you know, there's just a lot in that. And I think, though, that it's in that kind of stress that someone has to feel because of the...
I wanted to hug him, but I didn't know him.
Well, so that's inappropriate. And that's not appropriate. That's their space, you know. But this the fact that we would feel like... it's that power and privilege, and
it's
ubiquitous, and it's something that we really need to. I'm also white because it's a radio or podcast, so that I think really challenging ourselves to every single day be aware of that and think about what that means and think about what our actions do, and take that as a practice and think about it in terms of what we say, the meetings we have, who's there, who's around the table, who are we listening to. That's all really important. And I think it's if we're really going to make things better for moms, we really need to be thinking with much greater complexity about the approach.
Right, right. Well, you know, that'll take us into our next break. And when we come back, we're going to pull this all together and put a nice bow on top. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful thing. We're talking to Sarah Verbeest of the Jordan Institute for Families at UNC. And you're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. And we're back with Sarah Verbeest, who is getting me through my therapy session to learn about, I want to be the best grandmother ever, of course, and we have to bring all of these things together. Here's my takeaway from my life so far as a grandmother. If you thought you were out of school ever, forget it. You just have to keep learning. If you just keep learning, if you keep your mind open, and if you can let go of, maybe I did that wrong. And this is, to me, this is one of the most important things that I'm trying to convey to my son and daughter-in-law, who needs it less, I'll just be honest, that parenting is not a game for saints or people who demand perfection, because you're never going to get it. If you get through the day and you've made only one or two mistakes, that's been a stellar day as a parent. And I'm trying to get them to, you know, I would encourage them to keep a journal and, you know, keep notes and write things down, because your capacity to forget details of your own life is pretty amazing when you have kids. So we promised that we would wrap all this up and put a bow on it, and that's your job, Sarah. How would you wrap all this up and put a bow on it? Tell us about the great things that we have for young parents going forward that are going to make all of this so much better for the next generation.
Okay, then.
No pressure.
No pressure.
You have 6 minutes. Just go ahead.
Well, I think a couple of things come to mind. I think some words that have come to my mind on this topic are words like love and compassion, connectedness, and support.
I like those words, yes.
I think if we could start to be using those languages around new moms and new families, mm-hmm. And recognizing that the woman is the expert in her body and in this child.
Yeah.
So looking to her instead of always do this, listen to why she's doing something and learning from that, learning with her, I think would be excellent. I think really listening and asking questions are some things that providers can do a lot better. And actually not waiting for her to bring up the uncomfortable conversation, but actually making it easy for her by the kinds of questions that we ask. There's a, you know, concerns. Am I doing this right? Is this normal? Is this not normal? And I just think that recognizing we put a lot of burden on her.
Right. And including, as you say, things like, well, let me know if I can do anything. And now it's her job to find something for me to do to help.
That's, right.
No, that's not, you know.
Exactly.
I think she has enough.
May
to
I
do.
Bring you dinner? Can I help you fold some laundry? Would you like me to do the dishes? Can I vacuum?
Right.
Would you just like me to go home now and leave you alone?
Right.
That would be great, too.
That's for you, Grandma. Sometimes it's just time to go home. And, and by the way, I don't think a foot massage would offend anybody.
No. So I think that's the one thing that really comes to mind. I think that often we also can forget that we have also moms right now in our own community that have a lot of really unusual challenges. So moms who may not have documentation.
Right, right.
Who may have just had an emergency delivery and not even had coverage for postpartum care. We have moms who are in jail. Incarcerated. We have moms that are struggling with addiction. So we, again, it's so easy to just do blame on these women instead of also reach out with compassion and love and recognize that moms and babies in this fourth trimester are this intricately interwoven beings. And for them both to be well, we need to surround both of them with care, services, and support. And I think that would be a really important step forward.
Yeah.
I think listening to women, trusting women, really important.
And, you know, just, you know, nobody should be reluctant about encouraging a stranger in the line at the grocery store, in the elevator, in the waiting room at the doctor's office. And, you know, if it comes to your mind that you look at a young mom and you think, oh, you know, that she looks like she's got it going, you know, it looks like it's going great, and the beautiful baby. Say so. Don't just think it to yourself. Say so. There is a word of encouragement, it seems to me, to a young parent is never wasted language. It's not small talk.
No.
It's not small to the person receiving that little extension of love, which is what that is saying, you know, that's a beautiful baby. You know, you're doing a good job.
Right. One of the moms in one of our focus groups was talking about how she has a newborn and a 2-year-old. And she's like, you know, I know it's not going to last forever. And I love them so much.
However.
And it's really hard right now.
Yes.
And I think that's just a great way of saying it. It's also full of a lot of joy, lots of learning. And this is an important thing for our society. Mothering, parenting is an important thing for our society.
Yeah.
So we should lift it up.
And, man, everybody, you know, this isn't it funny? That comes right back to one of my first observations, which is how hysterical it is for somebody to say, I slept like a baby.
Yes.
You know, when they're toddlers and when you have the second one, and, you know, I hope my daughter-in-law doesn't listen to this because we're hoping for a second one, you know, It's the sleep. Oh, my goodness. Sleep is a miracle all in itself. And, you know, as you get older and you get less of it, I have to say, it still is a thing for me. It is so restorative and gives you your superpowers back.
Mm-hmm.
And giving a young mom a nap, you know, in the afternoon sometime when she really, really needs it that's a lot of help. You may not think that's that much help, but it's a lot.
Right. Well, and I hope we haven't put people to sleep with.
No, we
but
haven't.
But I think that I want to lift. I do want to say, you are smart to bring that up, because we would have been remiss to talk about this without talking about fatigue,
right,
and how it can continue for quite some time,
for quite a long time.
It can also play a role with emotions and feelings and balance.
Oh boy, you got that right.
Exactly, and I also feel like, in case my children listen to this.
And they will.
I love them both very much, and I would not trade a single minute of this journey.
Absolutely not.
We just have to recognize that we're not always fine. It's not always easy, and we need each other.
Even the minutes that we know perfectly well, we just don't remember. A friend of mine from high school was going through her residency to become a medical doctor when she had each of her children. She said, you know, I love them, but I really don't remember it that much. Because I just didn't sleep for about 3 years of my life. So, this has been just a joy to talk to you, and I hope that you'll come back and tell us when you have exciting things happening at the Jordan Institute. We've been talking with Sarah Verbeest, who is just, you know, it's terrible that Beast is in your name. I think it should be Sarah Verpussycat. How about that?
I'm tough. I'm a tough advocate
tough.
For social justice and change.
Okay, well then
I'll own the beast.
We will own the beast. I thank you so much for joining us. We're wildly over time, but that's our engineer's problem. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on the Weekend Water Cooler here on 97.9 The Hill, and y'all go out and have a fine weekend.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc, and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.